And so for those of you who just got on, well, the teacher's late, so you're not late. That's the way it goes. If the teacher's late, you're in good shape. So hello, everybody. I think I have 20 some odd, 22, 23 people on here when I looked to 25. Tom Miller's on. Hello, Tom. Louis Maynard, Steve Wise, hello Steve, hello Cam, hello Erica, hi, Leslie and Bob Block, hello Charles, and everybody. So let's go ahead and start this. I believe Catherine's probably started recording. And yeah, good morning from Cambodia. I feel like good morning Vietnam, but one of the students just hailed us from Cambodia. We do have people, as I counted, from 13 countries in this course, and that's most interesting to me. And welcome to all of you from Cambodia to Canada to the United States to the Netherlands, and glad to have you with us. And I'm sorry we had some technical difficulties, and I will... I'll keep you a little bit late so we make up for that, so we have plenty of time to chat, and I hope that works okay for you. This is Hunt Tooley, and it is lecture number 2 of the World War I course. You can see it there on the presentation. It's World War I, the Crucible of the Age of Statism. And, you know, we hope to have this over by Christmas, just as they did in 1914. Didn't happen for them, but we hope it will happen for us. And we're looking this time at the Battle of the Frontiers and crossing frontiers, both at the front and at home. It's the beginning of a consideration of how stalemate was formed, what stalemate meant, and then the broader implication of stalemate for the whole war, and all considerations on the domestic front, the intellectual element of the war, and so forth. So that's where we are, and I say we just start right in. I mentioned the Schlieffen Plan last time, and I want to say a little bit more about the Schlieffen Plan, because as I refer tonight to the Schlieffen Army or the Schlieffen Fronts or some form of that, I want to make sure everybody's on the same page. And so if you're on the page that says Schlieffen Plan, then you're on the same page. Remember that the Schlieffen Plan was a direct development of international relations, actually, but it was a German military plan. The development was this. In 1892, France and Russia got together in the Franco-Russian alliance. And this immediately set the Germans to thinking about a two-front war. And so, as you can see on that map, Russia's on one side, Germany's on the other. And the new chief of the general staff, Alf von Schlieffen, was charged with creating some kind of military policy that would take care of things in case Germany got into a two-front war. The plan he produced a few years later and then revised continually till his retirement in 1905, we called the Schlieffen Plan. The Germans often called the Mobilization Plan or a number of other things, but it is Alfred Schlieffen's plan. And it was changed a bit by his successor, Moltke. By and large, the same plan, although some historians see that as a very important issue that the plan was changed. The idea was to beat France first, to put the bigger part of the army, and I'll point out some things here. I hope you can see this arrow. Put the bigger part of the army right here on the Belgian border, and then lesser armies all the way down to the Swiss border. And each of these armies was to invade, but on the other hand, most of this country in here was not good country to invade through. It was along the Meuse River. It was very broken territory. So the northernmost army was the largest army, the one with the real impact, and that was to be the spot where the start of the war, the real knockout blow came. And I wish my little arrow would reverse here, but I don't know how to reverse it. So I'm having opposing arrows, but the big German Fifth Army, the largest of the invasion armies, was to attack through Belgium, violate Belgian neutrality, of course, and then turn to the west, southward to the west of Paris, and then move on around and essentially crush the French army here. And one reason they knew that the French army would be here is that the French army had an equally aggressive plan called Plan 17 that involved a drive of the heavy French right wing also, except this drive right on into Germany in hopes of kind of dismantling Germany and separating the South German states and all that. But in any case, Fifth Army was commanded by a commander named von Kluck, K-L-U-C-K, and Kluck was to have this big juggernaut of an army, 185,000 troops, and sometimes more, depending. And all this was to happen quickly so that France could be defeated within 6 weeks. The calculation was made based on 6 weeks because they figured that over here in the east, if you look at East Prussia, this little branch of Germany that branched far to the east in the Baltic, this little piece of the German Empire was vulnerable. And the assumption was, somebody has just said that there's no sound. Can I get some confirmation as to whether that is the case or not? I mean, did the sound go out? Okay, several people say that they can hear and see. And for whoever that was, I forget now. I'm sorry if you've lost sound. I don't think it's in general, but if you can't hear me, that explanation won't fool you anyway. So in this eastern area in East Prussia, it's a province called East Prussia, there was a high probability of attack, but the assumption was that Russian mobilization would last for longer than 6 weeks. It would take them the 6 weeks at least to get their armies in the field and all the troops gathered. And I mean, the roads were bad, the industrial level was low. And so, therefore, the plan was to fight a conventional war against the Russians in the east after a lightning kind of war, a war of encirclement in the West. So that's the Schlieffen plan. So when we refer to it, you'll know what that is. Of course, the plan's kind of messed up in the first place because the premise of the war, as we're going to see in just a moment, was that the Russians mobilized early by means of saying that they were going to half mobilize or partially mobilize. There are many clash potentials around. I mean, Austria-Hungary annexed Bosnia, what they considered a sort of loose province, the remnant of the Turks kind of withdrawing from power because of their revolution in 1908, the Young Turk Revolution. So Austria-Hungary decided to just snap up that piece of the weakening Ottoman Empire. And the Russians felt aggrieved at this. This could have led to war. I mean, this was a potential clash, and there was a lot of ugly talk between the two countries. You know, I put this out of order. I somehow got the assassination of the Archduke here before I got the Agadir crisis, so I'll just verbally put it back into order and change this. The Agadir crisis, the North African crisis in 1911, looked like there were warships coming from both France and from Germany, and it looked like there would be some hostilities. This was avoided. There were two Balkan wars, 1912 and 1913. Russia heavily involved in that. The Austrians also involved. It looked like that would bring a clash. And then finally, this assassination, sorry, it's out of order, of the Austrian heir to the throne in 1914. And so there were many clashes that could have done it, but this quite spectacular act of terrorism is the clash that brought the war on. And I think that's important to think about it in terms of just another clash. As I mentioned, Joachim Remach talked a famous American historian of the origins of the war used to talk about World War I as the Third Balkan War. Once the Archduke was assassinated, and he was assassinated in the little town of Sarajevo. I mean, there are several things that we should say about the Archduke. In fact, I think I'll give this a note on Franz Ferdinand. The Habsburg house was beset by troubles. It was a house that a dynasty that had lived by marrying well. And in the last few generations of the empire, this marriage policy of marrying the right princess or the right prince and therefore attaching different areas to Habsburg. You know, they said, others conquer, we marry, which is a fairly peaceable policy if you think about it. It gets a lot fewer people killed than conquest. But the Habsburgs found that this kind of disintegrated, and Franz Joseph, the Francis Joseph, who was on the Habsburg throne of Austria-Hungary from 1848 until 1916 when he died, he was unlucky in this. His son Rudolf, the heir to the throne, had not married as well as he wanted, then got involved with a woman and committed murder-suicide or suicide murder or something. This left the left no male heir, and so the succession went to Franz Joseph's brother, who died before he could assume the throne. So Franz Joseph's nephew, Franz Ferdinand, became the claimant to the throne and the Archduke and the heir to the throne, except that his marriage had not been a good one either. He had married a noblewoman from Austria-Hungary, but a woman who was not high enough in nobility to be considered a real match for a Habsburg emperor or ever to be in line for being Habsburg empress or anything. And so she was in a very carefully negotiated deal accompanied by many hard feelings. She, Sophie, was excluded, as were her children, from anything to do with the throne. Indeed, she was not permitted when in Austria-Hungary to attend any public function as the consort to Franz Ferdinand when he was appearing as in his capacity as Archduke. And this is one of the ironies of the situation. When he was in Sarajevo on June 28, 1914, Franz Ferdinand was there not as the Archduke of Austria. He was there as Inspector General of the Habsburg Army. And so he took every occasion he could to bring her along with him, to have her by his side when he was not appearing as the Archduke. And so she came with him and was therefore shot in the car with him. I give here a picture of the family. On the left is Sophie and their children. Franz Ferdinand, by some accounts, was an irascible person. By other accounts, was not especially irascible. It's hard to know at this remove exactly what kind of a person he was. He was certainly a believer in ending the kind of hyper-nationalism of the Hungarians. It's thought that he had a solution to the great nationality problem in Austria-Hungary. By giving the Slavs more say in the empire, having perhaps a triple kind of empire instead of a dual kind of empire, taking some of the wind out of the very nationalist Hungarian sails. We're not sure of that. His cousin, Rudolf, studied, of course, with Karl Menger. And so we kind of associate the house with this, with the Austrian school of economics, and of course another descendant, Otto von Habsburg, was a very good friend of not only Austrian economics in general, but the Mises Institute in particular. So there is this a kind of a thought about Franz Ferdinand. But it certainly it made sense to from the standpoint of people who were hyper-nationalist Serbian, greater Serbian folks, because if Franz Ferdinand was about to solve the problems of the Habsburg Empire, then why would any Slavs in the southern part of the Habsburg Empire be concerned or worried enough or marginalized enough to want to go to Serbia? So that makes a lot of sense. This is the Emperor Franz Josef, in other words, the uncle of the Archduke, who is there on the day of the 28th, June 28th, 1914, and there she is beside him. In a letter to Wilhelm, it's often said that Franz Josef didn't like Franz Ferdinand very much, and they had gone through this difficult negotiation in which, you know, Franz Ferdinand's wife was snubbed. But it's also true that I think they got over that. I think they were Habsburgs and considered that it was the same team and that they got over that. Certainly, Franz Josef wrote to the German Emperor, Wilhelm II, a few days after the assassination of the terrible catastrophe of Sarajevo. I don't know that that's especially personal. I think that Wilhelm II thought that he was a friend to Franz Ferdinand and kind of looked forward to having a sort of counterpart who was a little closer to his own age in running the Triple Alliance and in running the kind of Central European part of Europe. But I think everybody was shocked by this terrible tragedy. It was a spectacular and colossal act of terrorism. Serbian financed Bosnian Serbs killed these people during a public parade, and it would be tantamount to a neighboring country today sponsoring the assassination of the heir to the throne or maybe the president-elect or something like that. It's a big act of terrorism. And when I was working on this, on the Western Front, the World War I book, it was part of that was during a period of 9/11. And it certainly occurred to me that the way I'd been taught in college was that these Austrians, they were so persnickety. All that happened was that their heir to the throne got killed by some terrorists who were financed by a very irascible and difficult neighbor. And that's kind of the way it was taught in the 70s. But the more I've thought about this over the years, and the more I thought, well, that's not quite right. I mean, they had a right to be pretty angry. And then 9/11 happened, and I don't know if all of you remember that. Some of you are very young and may not remember this as distinctly as others, but most of us remember that 9/11 happened, and all of us were upset. I mean, there's no way not to be devastated by this whole event. And I mean, the feeling was, even if you understood the temptations and the urges of going to war and declaring war on everybody and all that, the feeling was, man, something's got to be done. Somebody has to do something here. We can't just stand by and let all these things happen. And I'm happy to say that attitude, passed quickly on the parts of many of us who were associated with the Mises Institute at that time. But that was the attitude. Well, in any case, the start of our war with Afghanistan in 2001 was that we delivered an ultimatum, and it had 5 points. And as I was working through this material for the World War I book, it occurred to me, well, wait a minute, these 10 points of the Austrian ultimatum to Serbia in July 1914 are very, very similar. And so I've put these up here as a kind of comparison. I've got Gavrilo Princip lurking in the background and Osama lurking in the background there too. I think there's great similarity in points 1, 4, and 5 that President Bush declared before Congress on September 20th, 2001, and the ultimatum that was sent to the Serbian government. So deliver all the leaders of Al-Qaeda, close the terrorist bases, hand over terrorists to the United States, give the United States full access to going into Afghanistan and rooting out terrorist camps. And the Serbian one was very similar, to remove the military and administrative people who had been guilty in the operation, to agree to report and work with and allow in the imperial agents of Austria into to investigate the subversion, and to institute judicial inquiry and cooperate and report with Austria. So these are very, very similar kinds of demands. And in both cases, the governments actually agreed with many of these, but balked at the what they both call the invasion of sovereignty. So it's a very similar situation, spectacular act of terrorism, ultimatum, and then the war starts. I point that out. I mean, I don't think that history repeats itself necessarily, but these are quite similar trains of events, and I think it helps you understand the outbreak of the war better from whatever standpoint, the outbreak of World War One, from whatever standpoint. I think people just went along with this thinking, well, this was a terrible act. I mean, Austria was the victim here, and something had to be done. And indeed, the Serbians turned down those parts of the ultimatum, and so Austria attacked, just as Austria had said she would. Belgrade was bombarded at first from rivers, and then the army crossed the border. You can see Serbian soldiers rushing to the front there on July 28th. That's the Detroit News of July 29th. And so the war started, but of course it wasn't a world war yet. It was just another Balkan war. It was just a war between Serbia and Austria. I put a kind of two-page chronology here that might clear these things up for you. I think the series of events here is very important. I mean, we're going to talk about all facets of the war, but we need to get this this beginning right before we move on. And here it goes. So on July 23rd, Austria-Hungary delivered this ultimatum to Serbia. The Serbs proposed arbitration, but they also mobilized, which in those terms of modern industrial war, that meant that they were getting ready to fight a war, and that war was extremely likely from their standpoint. So diplomatic ties were severed on July 25th, and Austria-Hungary mobilized troops. There was an attempt to mediate, didn't work, and war was declared on Serbia by the Austrians on July 28th. The British called for an international mediation, everybody was urging everybody to restrain. Except that, as we see here, Austrian warships bombarded Belgrade, and in reaction to this attack, then on July 31st, Russia began mobilization of its troops. Indeed, I should have said that's actually wrong. That July 31st, that's partial mobilization. I should have written partial. I don't know why I wrote full. Mobilization of troops. And Germany, let's see if I can write partial there. That's partial. Well, you get the picture. Began mobilization, and that was partial mobilization. And Germany demanded that Russia stop the mobilization, even if it was partial. But By the thinking of the Schlieffen plan, if Russia mobilized, then the plan is you got to attack France first. Once they mobilize, then the clock is ticking, and so you have to do something at that point. I know it sounds rigid, and I know it sounds unreasonable, but that's the mindset that the Germans were in. We have only the one plan, and that's it. So Germany declared war on France after making up a kind of story about how France had goaded Germany into war, and bring up the attack on France. And of course, neutral Belgium was invaded. Britain then sent an ultimatum because Belgium was linked to Britain by treaty, as were the Germans linked to Belgium by treaty. And the British demanded the Germans withdraw on August 3rd, and then August 4th, Britain declared war on Germany. So that's how we get the war started. Not everybody was in it at once, but it becomes the World War when we get to August 4th. Everybody at the time was, every thinking person was concerned. All the diplomats, Sidney B. Fay once pointed out that these were all people who, and he had interviewed, I think, all of them, or most of them, and he said all of them mentioned that they hadn't slept for the whole month of July. They were tired. These guys look kind of tired, actually, if you think about it. The top one is the German chancellor, and he kept talking about a leap in the dark, meaning that Germany's just going to gamble and throw the dice and roll the Schlieffen plan and see if all this works. The British foreign minister, Sir Edward Grey, is famous for having written this also a comment on darkness. We were standing at the window of my room in the Foreign Office. It was getting dusk, and the lamps were being lit in the space below on which we were looking. My friend recalls that I remarked on this with the words, "The lamps are going out all over Europe. We shall not see them lit again in our lifetime." My point here is that these great statesmen act as if fate or something else drove them. These comments about the darkness, I mean, they're influenced by the general mood. You know, we've already talked about how there's a kind of Freudian thing in the air, a Nietzschean thing in the air about people thinking in more mystical ways, or more sort of thinking of the unconscious and subconscious and sort of modes of mood and thinking. We talk about a general pessimism or a cultural malaise, an ennui I mentioned last week, and these guys were infected with this. They act like they couldn't themselves have just said, "No, we're not going to go to war." They're acting as if they're forced to do it, but wars are a human action. I mean, they can be chosen, and you can choose a war if you or you not choose a war. In other words, human beings make these wars. There's a very, very haunting and beautiful poem by Thomas Hardy, who that kind of prefigures the war. And if you want to go read that, I think it's a lovely poem and brings up many of the issues that we're going to bring up that we're going to talk about in this course. But it's called Channel Firing, and I've put the link there. Well, people in Europe were ecstatic with this whole situation. And this picture is from Munich, in a place that maybe some of you have been. Maybe you're quite familiar with it. It's called the Odeonsplatz. It's one of the famous venues in Munich. And somebody took a picture of this cheering crowd. You know, there were crowds all over the capitals of Europe and the big cities out, you know, in the day of the newsboys and the news being posted in windows and on kiosks and so forth. And crowds would be out and about. It was a very public kind of atmosphere in Europe, and this was a real urban moment for all these people. Huge crowds. They were mainly jubilant crowds. They were mainly cheering for the war. So they were mainly pro-war crowds. There were anti-war crowds, but they were crowds of 15 and 20 people. They weren't very large. We'll talk more about anti-war movements during the war later. But in any case, Years and years later, when Hitler was on his way to fame and fortune as the head of the Nazi Party and the head of the Third Reich, then it was said that he had been in that crowd on that day, and this picture was discovered, and somebody went through it with a very big magnifying glass and finally found Hitler there. If the story is true, it's also possible that this is a fake, faked up photo just to get Hitler in that crowd. If so, it's a pretty good fake, but and maybe some of you know more about that than me, but this, there's a famous kind of controversy as to whether this is a fake. I like to think not. I like to think he was as happy as anybody else. I mean, that would fit perfectly. He was a very politically oriented person. He had moved to Vienna. To Munich. He followed politics all the time, and so this may be an actual reaction photo of Hitler before he was ever anybody. The only problem is he does look kind of old, and he has a Hitler mustache at a time before we know that in the wartime he had a big curly mustache. So maybe it's a fake. Anyway, but the crowd photo around him, that's the actual 1914 crowd, and they are jubilant. Soldiers were jubilant too. There's a wonderful account of counterparts to these German soldiers that you see on the screen. And it's a French regiment leaving for the front, an exact analog to these guys on the train, because they're headed west in Alsace-Lorraine, and these troops were leaving from Paris to go to Alsace-Lorraine and encounter each other. So in a famous passage, one of the participants said, "Our colonel stood before us and as before we left for the train station said, 'The main message I want to give to you today is love each other.' And he said, in that moment, we were united in a national feeling of defending our country." And then he says, "We went to the train station, and as it pulled out, as if by magic, everybody in the train began singing the Marseillaise." And then he says, as we rolled out of Paris and rolled along through the countryside toward Alsace, by magic, flowers appeared on the trains, and people would wave flags at us at crossroads, and it was as if the heart of a great nation, he said, was beating once again. So through all those years, he tells us, when there was this vile negotiation and politics and business as usual, well, now our heart was beating again. And it was an experience like none before. So this is an account. I mean, inside the minds of these soldiers, this is also a flower-bedecked transport headed to war. Everybody's happy. The little slogans chalked on the sides are upper right, "Ausflug nach Paris." That means, as I'm sure many of you know, it means excursion to Paris. And then "Auf Wiedersehen auf dem Boulevard." And so, see you later on the boulevard in Paris. And so these guys, they've got flowers, they've got no doubt schnapps, they've got cigarettes, they are happy and excited to go to war. One thing that's come up in recent research, a French author has written an excellent book, and some other research has been clustered around that in different countries. But one thing that's quite clear is we used to think that all the publics were kind of duped and gulled into being excited about this war. But it turns out that this was an almost purely urban phenomenon. In other words, people in the cities were excited about the war. But on the other hand, in European countries, the people who had been the soldiers for generations and generations and centuries were not so much city people. Usually the bourgeois and city workers and producers of that type were protected. The people who were swept up instead, in a general way, except for the lowest of the low and genro being, brought into the Navy or something, the people who usually fought the wars were the peasants. So European armies, having been in so many wars, peasants having been killed in so many wars, it turns out in rural France there was much, much less enthusiasm. People were somber. People understood better what was coming. And I think that this probably research will show that that this was the tendency everywhere. I think it's certainly the tendency in the United States. I mean, one of the reasons that the western part of the United States came to be much more anti-war than the east was that it was much more rural, and I think for the same reasons. I'm guessing now. I haven't done the research on that, and I don't know of sufficient research to say that, but I think it's a good guess. So here's the invasion, and there was an invasion. It was very, very hot. That August. August is often very, very hot in Europe, and this was one of those hot ones. And these are Germans in their woolen uniforms, many of them passing out from heat exhaustion as they walk into France and invade it in 1914. That's, I think, quite a spectacular picture. Well, the first thing that happened, and if you think back to that map about the Schlieffen Plan, the first thing that's going to happen in terms of a big German attack, hostilities start up all along the line between France and Germany where there was contact between the armies. But the first big battles came from this right wing, the German First Army. Did I say Fifth earlier? It's the German First Army, which was invading through the narrow gap between the Ardennes Mountains on the south and then the little tip of the Netherlands that contains Maastricht in it. And so the Germans went through avoiding the Netherlands and staying out of the Ardennes in this narrow path, and the first thing that stood in their way was the Belgian city of Liège, which it turns out was a fortified city, originally fortified by Vauban and other fort builders of the 17th and 18th centuries, but recently upgraded so that there were modern mound-like forts with hidden artillery turrets and a lot of modern accoutrements on those forts. And they ringed about the city of Liège, so it really was a fortified city. I mean, they're not connected, but those forts in wartime by the Belgian army were connected a little bit by trenches, so there's this kind of ring around the city. The biggest fort, the most important, was called Fort Loncin, L-O-N-C-I-N, and there's a picture of it here after the Germans take it. But I must tell you this, there's some very important things about these early battles in Belgium, and one of the things is the Germans didn't take this immediately. The Schlieffen Plan called for them to walk over the Belgians, and frankly, the Belgian army was in the midst of a big reorganization, which should have meant that the Belgians just collapsed. But in fact, the army did not. The officers were well-trained. The Belgians were fighting for their country and rallied round. And the defense of these fortresses around Liège, it was really quite spectacular. The Germans brought up heavy artillery, much of it, of course, made by the Krupp manufacturers. And they pounded these forts into rubble, but these forts weren't so easy to get at. Eventually, they are reduced, but only after about 7, 8, and in some cases 9 days. It's a little, we'd have to go into particulars to talk about how long it actually took to reduce these forts and get past Liège. But that's an important part of all this. The Germans were held up, the Schlieffen Plan was held up right at the beginning. And then some other things happened. It's a little bit of a Lord of the Rings kind of story where everybody does a little bit of their part and then the German Schlieffen Plan didn't work. And this was the very first part. The interesting thing to me about all this is that the Germans with their new big army still attacked in column. And let me explain what that means. Modern tactics for a long time had spread soldiers out to get a broad field of fire. But there were discussions about this going back through the 18th and 17th centuries. And one of the things that Napoleon introduced for his mass armies, his armies of people who were not as well trained, was attacking in columns so that there would be a rectangular formation of men attacking a given point, and the guys from behind basically would push the guys in front into the enemy. So there wasn't as much fire because the people inside the rectangle really couldn't fire. But on the other hand, they had all this esprit and they didn't get scared and they were in one big clump. It's kind of military psychology. So this was discussed over and over again. And the Germans in their fairly enlarged army, which was well trained but fairly enlarged, they still didn't trust their troops at the very beginning of the war to spread out and attack in any kind of effective order. So the very first attacks of the First World War by the Germans against the Belgian forts were all in column, and the forts just shot down people left and right. This goes to a further point that I'll make again tonight, and that is that this first stage of the war, this stage of the war of movement, is the deadliest. For all that we think of the trenches, the increasing artillery, and all these slaughters of 1916, and the even worse slaughters of 1917, for all that we think of those as being deadly, these first 6 months where people stood above the ground and attacked, those are the deadliest. The trenches were the friend of the soldiers. Another thing that was happening, as the French attacked through Belgium, of course the other four armies were occupied with moving into France more slowly. The French had the mass of its army in front of the in Alsace, in front of what was called the Lorraine Gap. And that French army resisted the Germans but fell back. And almost all of the French defense took the form of offense. I guess they were the originators of the expression, the best defense is a good offense, because the French reasoned that that while the English were good at defending historically, the French were good at attacking historically, and that the English were not very good on the attack, but that the French were really good, they were really good on the attack and not good at defense. So so there were these stand-up counterattacks. So the French would go out to meet the Germans, a front would be established, and the French would attack over ground like this. I mean, this is World War One. This is a 1914 attack. It's probably into September already in this photograph, but they're still running across open ground, clumped together, very, very close, and they will all be, all but most will be killed. I mean, this was a very, very deadly period. I'll show you some statistics later on that bear this out. But I do often say this. I mean, my students at Austin College are often impacted by this redneck idea that the French are always running away from something. But let me tell you, the French attacked more in World War One than any other country. And again, if we're going to be on the, and I am on the soldier side in all this, if we're going to talk about this from the standpoint of soldiers, these were brave individuals facing this. I think all the armies, all the individuals in the armies tended to be courageous in that war, but these French attacked without much question. It's quite amazing, and this is a great picture of them. Okay, well, so that's on the attack, but let me talk about defense. The delay, and let me get my little pointer out. The delay here at the beginning, you see, Maastricht is about there, and the little peninsula of the Netherlands. I don't know if we have our Netherlands student online with us, but the little thing that sticks down there, that's the Netherlands, and so hence the need for the Cook's column to go through this 15-mile or so, 10 or 15-mile gap between the Netherlands and the Ardennes. And so they were held up right here at Liège, right at the opening, and for about 10 days, 8 or 10 days, depending on how you count. And then the Belgian army fell back, fought again, fell back then on Antwerp, and Kluck found that he had to bleed off a bunch of his troops to go up there and besiege Antwerp. And so the big strike force, 185,000 people in the German First Army, that was already bled away by the battles at Liège and also by this force that had to go to Antwerp. And then meanwhile, basically the disaster for the Schlieffen plan occurred. Of course, there's also fighting, I should point out, there's also fighting all along here with the French. I'm just talking about the Belgian part. I don't want to mislead you, because there's I could have drawn arrows all along here, but I thought it would be more confusing. But the change comes, the game changer comes when the British Expeditionary Force, the BEF, landed at Le Havre on August 16th, and also at Boulogne. And from there, this British Expeditionary Force moved through the countryside and attacked. Well, let's say this: they set themselves up in front of the big German juggernaut of the First Army, and fought a series of battles that are famous in story and song, and I think rightly so. This BEF was, and here's a picture of them the day before the first of these great battles. The BEF, in my view, was, I guess, the most effective military force in the world at this time. The other empires had their armies out fighting pretty much solely people who were generations behind them militarily. On the other hand, the BEF had actually fought wars in which the enemy, at least because of numbers and organization, could have beaten them and sometimes did beat them. The British Army had faced very stiff opposition in the 1880s and 90s in Sudan and so forth and so in other places, in Afghanistan and other places. And so it was a professional army, and the army that Kitchener sent over from England in the very first days of the war, miraculously getting it there by just a few days after the outbreak. Think of it. August 4th, the war is on. August 16th, the BEF arrives. It's over 100,000 men. It's a professional army. Even the soldiers, the private soldiers, have been to some extent trained for war. All the non-coms have seen combat somewhere, and they march like mad across Flanders to get to a place. The first one being Mons, where they put themselves in front of von Kluck's army, and here they are stretching out for rest in the town center of Mons in Belgium the day before the battle. The battle of Mons was the first battle, and they dug in. They dug scrapes. You see these scrapes on the left, they called them, and they were more like foxholes. The funny thing is that the foxholes would turn into trenches, but after the war, toward the end of the war, they would turn back into foxholes, and that's what we get for World War II. But here are some British soldiers on the left-hand side here in their scrapes waiting for the Germans to appear. And this is either at Mons or Le Cateau, I don't know. But that little jagged group, if we blew this picture up, and you probably can blow it up or find it on the internet, and then blow it up, those are German troops approaching. So this is one of these fairly rare shots. We don't have too terribly many shots of actual combat situations, but this is a fantastic picture that shows all this happening. So what they would do is fight like mad at Mons. They fought a huge battle of defense, and at the last minute, when they were just about to break, then their officers had them retreat. And here they are retreating. And then they set up before Le Cateau, fought a madly defensive battle, had fewer losses than the Germans. The Germans really had to get around them or go over them. Remember, the Germans have been delayed. And then when they nearly are unable to go on, then they retreat again. And there are several more actions before the, I'm sorry, I had a, another slide there. There's several more actions of lesser note. The two big battles are Mons and Le Cateau. And then they move back in a series of actions and then fall into line with the French army. And this pretty much put paid to the sleeping plan. I'd say the Belgian defense at Liège and this this thing. Meanwhile, some other stuff happens that that hurts too. But these are two big frictions of war, as Clausewitz would have called them, that that didn't do the Germans any good. The other thing was that we would bring up in terms of the Schlieffenplan is in the east, and has to do with the Russian invasion, because everybody thought the Russians would take 6 weeks, but in fact they had cheated by starting mobilization, partial mobilization early, and well, it turns out that the Russians just didn't need 6 weeks to field a couple of armies and to invade then East Prussia, that that province on the that juts out far into Russian territory in the east, or that jutted out far in the east. And so these armies invaded. There was a war of invasion. The German army, this small Schlieffen force that was supposed to just kind of hang on until the rest could get there, it was pushed back. There was an attack toward Königsberg. It looked like the German city of Königsberg would fall. And so the two generals from the were sent there to take over. Hindenburg, who was in retirement, he was brought out of retirement, and then a hotshot general staff colonel called Ludendorff was sent to be his chief of staff, and they went to the east, reorganized the German forces, and then consolidated the German 8th Army and managed to bring their Russians to battle. That wasn't hard. The Russians were pretty much headed for Königsberg. And at Tannenberg, the, a huge, an enormous battle on August 26th to August 30th, they defeated the Russians so soundly, so massively, just destroying the Russian force, that the general, Samsonov, rather than report to the Tsar, actually committed suicide on July 29th. I mean, on the August 29th. The casualties were, as you see, completely lopsided. Russians, 170,000, Germans, 12,000. A week later, Hindenburg and Ludendorff engaged the second of the Russian armies there under Rennenkampf and defeated him at the Battle of the Masurian Lakes. Now, there were many more battles in the east over the next 6 months, 8 months, but still in all, the Russian force was broken, and the Eastern Front, especially in the north, for the next couple of years was a pretty stable front, and we'll talk more, much more about that later. But this this whole business, the Tannenberg, Hindenburg and Ludendorff brought extra troops with them. They weakened the Western Front, and so this could have, it's clearly could have contributed also. Historians give these things different weights. But with all this invasion happening, what's going on back in the West is that the French commander, and this war is mostly in France, right? It's we've talked about Belgium, but the French army is making all these counterattacks and fighting across its own territory. The German army is invading. Von Kluck was forced by the British to turn south, but not outside of Paris, not outside on the west side of Paris, but actually on the east side of Paris, because he was blocked that way. And he had gotten away from the other units of the army. They hadn't moved as far and as fast as they thought. There were many frictions of war. And so in moving to the west of Paris, enables Joffre to organize a counterattack. After a long wait and a big retreat, Joffre waited until the German army got as far as being sort of directly to the east of Paris, along the Marne, a stretch of the Marne River. And so Joffre then launched an assault, got the British to launch an assault on Darien. And this first Battle of the Marne, there would be a couple more, but this the 1914 Battle of the Marne pushed the Germans back up, and so the Schlieffen Plan itself was broken up as a result of all these factors. Now, the German army didn't give up. They tried to assault one last time and break through, and we'll see what this was called in a minute. But basically, the general picture is that after they're unable to break through, then they fall back about 5 miles behind where the front lines were to get into prepared positions that they had their engineers digging in the rear. And so the Allies then close up and dig in. And here's a picture of the French Marne attack. Again, a picture from very early in the war. We call this last little bit, after the Marne battle, sort of envision here the Marne battle having taken place way down in this area of France, where that arrow is in that lower right-hand corner. And the Germans are being pushed back there, but they think that they can especially work on the junction of the French and the British troops in this sector, and the Belgian troops over here. They think that they can get, they can break through, and this would be especially important because they can get this line of ports from Belgian ports from Nieuport onward along the North Sea, and that would be in the Channel, and that would be very advantageous for submarine work and so forth. And so there's a reason why they were trying so desperately to break through. And so the line follows, they move forward in this sector, where I have the little arrow, if you can see it, and I'll move it down now. In this sector, we're talking September and October, and then early November, there's a vicious battle here. The Germans are on their last legs. They're just trying to avoid the stalemate. They want anything but a continual war. Remember, their whole idea was to beat France fast, and they're almost desperate. When we get to Langemarck here, where the arrow is, if you can see that, and I'll move that a little bit, Langemarck, that's a place where they were calling up everybody. They got French, they got German cadets to come from a military school. They got student groups, they got fresh, untrained, or little trained units from everywhere to just throw themselves at the British, and they were killed here. I'll show you an example of that in just a moment. It's what the Germans came to call the slaughter of innocents at Langemarck, this attack. All of this right outside of the city of Ypres, which we'll be concerned with in quite a fair degree throughout this course. Ypres, today Ypres, of course, in the Flemish pronunciation in Belgium. At the time, all these Flemish towns were called by their French names, by their haughty Walloon overlords. But I'm kind of kidding. I don't want to insult any Walloons who happen to be in the group. But it's now called Ypres on the road signs, and the French name was Ypres. But it was a city that was partially fortified, but that basically was a last standing point, because off the map over in that direction, there's a kind of a hill called Mount Kimmel that if you can get artillery up there, then it's over. Then you've got the coast. In other words, if the Germans had broken through on one side here or straight through or somewhere, then they could have taken Mount Kimmel very easily, and that might have been their ticket to the end of the war. But in fact, they couldn't get past it. The British made a stand here at Ypres. There were Belgian troops from the end of the Western Front right here. Belgians up to Dixmude, and then I believe they go that far. and then it turns to British. The British passed Ypres, and then roughly down to Armentières or somewhere in that sector. It has changed a little bit over time. Then the French start there. So it's Belgians, British, and then a long, long line of French off on the rest of the front. But here the British stood and fought. And again, it's this spectacular defense that is related to the other great defenses in the retreat. But they just didn't ever decide to give up on Ypres, and that's a spectacular battle. It's called the First Battle of Ypres, and it rages from October to November. And it's the last gasp of the Germans in terms of trying to break through. And so they call this the Race to the Sea, in that they're trying to get around, make an end run, sort of. It's not really a race to the sea, but that was what the journalists called it at that time. But the Entente forces hung on, and by virtue of all these events, you see the Western Front that developed here. Here's Belgium up here. We were looking at this just now in close form, and the Western Front makes this kind of weird S. So it's S-shaped here, goes down to here, curves. Paris is over here. You can see that. the front then curved here and around the fortified city of Verdun. Then it turns south and goes on all the way to the Swiss border, about 400 miles. We're going to talk a lot about that front. I mean, there's much more to say about it, but this is the Western front from one end to the other. The Western Front today, I should just mention, is surrounded by graves, and so many of these graves are the graves of people killed in 1914, every other year too. But for just having fought for a few months of 1914, these losses were just unbelievably high. I mentioned the slaughter of the innocents. Here's the German military cemetery at Langemarck, Belgium. And in the center, they took the bodies. There were so many that even at the time, the Germans couldn't basically figure out who was who, disentangle them. They collected the names. But they put the bodies in a mass grave, and that became the core of the later cemetery that was consolidated after the war. 25,000 German soldiers are there, about 8,000 unidentified, and many of them are students. Many of them are young people who were fired up about the war and marched right into the British machine guns. So. That's a sad reminder. Indeed, I think the thing that impresses one most, and some of you have done this, I'm sure, in fact, some of you live in the proximity to it, one of the things that's the most shocking about the Western Front is that as you go there today, there are plenty of signs of World War I, but the main one is that you just follow the cemeteries. They put all these bodies somewhere, and it's in the cemeteries, German, French, British, and you just follow that all the way down to Switzerland. Soldiers already understood what was involved here. We're going to talk about a lot of artists and poets. Max Beckmann was a man who already had an idea that he didn't want to kill somebody, so he joined the ambulance corps and was absolutely shocked by what he saw. And one of his first pieces of art from the war, and he became a well-known and great 20th century artist, but one of his first pieces was this drawing that appeared in a German publication in 1914. He had drawn it a few weeks into the war, Mars Unleashed and Woman Mourning. So she's covered there with a shroud. Mars appears as a kind of muscular skeletal figure engaged in his head is more like a skull. It's a real commentary, another kind of presage of what is to come. And at the bottom, Beckmann or his editors appended the German mobilization decree of August 1914. Well, this trench warfare meant, for one thing, that soldiers were safer, and they make a home there. And so I just got some early photos of these trenches to show that people were then below the earth, and that these are very crowded trenches, not very well dug. Later in the war, they get very much improved and get very homey. But even from the beginning, soldiers managed to find a little bit of shelter and dig out some spots to be a little bit safer in those trenches. Casualties from all this that I've been talking about, everything, Belgian casualties 50,000, British casualties nearly 100, not quite, 95, 96,000, Serbs 170,000 casualties in a very brief war. The Germans had 952,450. The French even more. And let me add that the Germans were fighting two fronts. In other words, these are the casualties from the Russian invasion and Tannenberg and the Masurian Lakes, and also the Western Front. So the Germans were fighting a two front war, and the French still outnumbered them in casualties. These attacks turned out to be murderous. So, and let me just say about these casualties: these are not deaths; these are KIA killed, wounded, missing, and prisoners. So these are several categories. But still, in all, you see the sums here. And for any of these, in any of the modern wars, you can pretty much assume about a third will be deaths, at least in Western Europe. So. I don't have the figures for German deaths ahead of me, but we're talking in the range of 300,000. And so here's a great successful attack here in this little faded out picture behind us. It's the French in the trenches with the Germans they've just killed to get in to take those trenches. A horrific war indeed. I want to turn briefly, and we're coming to toward the conclusion, but I have a couple things to say yet before we end up and do our questions. From the very beginning, the countries involved worked in what I call a kind of Higgsian way, a Robert Higgs way. I'm again referring to his great book, Crisis and Leviathan, and his theory that governments grow huge in times of crisis. They tend to leap forward in terms of their growth and power in times of crisis. And in this supreme crisis, all countries then assumed pretty much a complete police power, at least the potential of complete power at the beginning of the war. On August 8th already, and the war's only 4 days old, Parliament passes the Defense of the Realm Act. We call that DORA. And it exists to the present day. It never dropped off the charts. It's been changed many times. But in the original, it was a statement that the security of the people to prevent spying, to make for the safety of the empire, that His Majesty's forces would be able to do pretty much anything they wanted to. And therefore, in the tiny print and in the regulations that followed, there were all kinds of DORA regulations to keep people from flying kites because they might be signaling German subs. They couldn't hang up washing within a mile of the coast because they might be hanging their sheets and towels in a code to give the Germans some hints of that. People were restricted in movements anywhere close to the coast. There are many more powers that the government took on itself. There were powers to do with the mail and everything else that we'll investigate later. But the DORA is the kind of model for us. But the Austro-Hungarians had declared martial law already on July 25th, the Germans on July 31st, and the Germans expanded that into what they call siege law a little later. Canada created its own DORA. It called the War Measures Act on August 22nd. Russia had autocracy anyway. It was always under basically kind of martial law. Germans occupied part of France, but in the non-German occupied part of French, domestic security laws were piecemeal, but they did exist. They had censorship, they had police powers against movement and so forth, but they were carried out along separate lines. They didn't have any general martial law. In the United States, and this is much later, in 1917, when the United States gets in, DORA came in the form of the Espionage and Sedition Acts of 1917 and 1918. So governments are immediately taking powers themselves. These include powers against free speech, forced censorship. They include powers of the mails. Almost immediately, there was a potential, and in many cases, the actual fact of opening up mails. And there's also clearly a definition here, an act of definition in describing people as enemies, which we'll have to talk about a lot later. That's for the future. All countries involved in the war took measures for the appearance of unity. The most famous and most unified cases of this were was the French conglomeration of parties, which they all got together and declared that they wouldn't be petty and party political for the duration of the war, that they would fight the common enemy and keep the Germans out. And they called this kind of wonderful togetherness, this war togetherness, they called that the Union Sacrée, the Sacred Union. And there were many references to it, but it had no real force behind it. And to tell you the truth, politics didn't start. The parties were always beating each other over the heads with this phrase, the Union Sacrée, accusing the others of having broken this sacred union. A similar thing in Germany, where immediately in the parliament, all the parties voted for and agreed upon a Bürgerfrieden, the civil peace. And that was exactly the same thing that the French had done. And it was used in exactly the same way. Although I think there was more unity, it was as if the war party had taken over every party, even the Social Democrats, the mainstream Social Democrats. However, in voting for the war credits, the hardcore left of the Social Democratic Party in Germany, the SPD, in fact refused to vote for the war credits. And refused to vote to finance the war. And so there was a split in the party, and what emerged from this was the creation of a second socialist party, a second SPD, and that was called the USPD, USPD, the Independent Socialist Party. That was the Radical Socialist Party. Now, many of these people were thrown in jail during the war, and many were kept quiet, and there wasn't free debate in Parliament. In fact, there will be military dictatorship in 1916. But they existed. There was one single party itself that was anti-war, and that was the Independent Socialist Party. In the British version of unity, I think, was business as usual. This was highly touted as a strategy to take on the war. Business as usual. There's John Bull just carrying out business as usual, you see. I want to say a little bit about the blockade. I mean, this is also a domestic way of countering things in the war, but this is a very particular issue. Early on, as Lord of the Admiralty, Winston Churchill, whom you see in this picture there, can you see him? Recognize, there he is. This is after he had failed miserably for a while and decided just to throw it all away and join the army again. He had been in the army before, but he had been a Chancellor of the Exchequer and Chancellor he'd been the Lord, First Lord of the Admiralty, which is like the Secretary of the Navy. He was a pretty important politician. And what he started thinking about already in August 1914 and September 1914, he was thinking of the war as a demographic war. In other words, he thought, well, if we fight the Germans to a standstill, then it will be a war of attrition. It will be bodies. It will be supplies, it will be industry, and we will just try to outproduce and outlive the other side. And one way we can cut that short is to blockade the continent and blockade all food from going to Germany. Now, this was strictly illegal in international terms, but it's what he thought about. And it was helped by the fact that Churchill didn't like the Germans very much at all, thought that the whole population was somehow an enemy. Many leaders from the late 19th century to the 20th century have convinced themselves that the people are the enemies. As General Sherman once said when he was commandant of Memphis, occupational commandant of Memphis during the Civil War, all the people around us are now guerrillas and guerrilla fighters, and that's kind of what Churchill was thinking about the German population. So you starve some civilians, so you starve elderly people and women, so you cause death and destruction from disease, then, well, that's okay, because they're the ones who are guilty, kind of collective guilt. Ralph Rako has written a wonderful article that's actually a review of Paul Vinson's book on this, and I give those things there. But this too is a domestic decision, far from the battlefront. That's important here. Finally, I want to point out that there's other brutality involved here. I mean, the war itself is there's a prelude of brutality. We've already talked that about that in terms of the empire and the social Darwinism and so forth. But there were many brutal things that happened. The Germans drove into France and Belgium, and it is really true that they had taken to heart all of the Hague decisions and the Geneva agreements about warfare. But they had taken them to heart in the sense that I believe everybody else also took to heart. That is to say, well, if it's in the regulations, it's okay. If somebody has on a uniform, that's okay. But otherwise, if anybody lifts a finger against us, they're the enemy. There's enemies all around us, you know. The same reason of identifying the enemies. Again, a theme that I want to play upon later. So the Germans came in, and when old Belgian men, raised their blunderbusses, their pheasant blunderbusses, and shot at a German column out a window, the Germans started shooting people in that town or village in reprisal. There were fires that broke out in places. The German troops were sometimes not under good discipline. They had received very rough treatment from the Belgian army, and it's traditional that soldiers get back at the civilian population. And the Germans did this in both France and Belgium. And the Russians did it in Russia, in East Prussia as well. Now, what we know about German atrocities generally comes from a horrifically propagandistic report called the Bryce Report that was issued in 1915. And I'm going to talk much more about that later. That's a very important aspect of the war. That won't come out till 1915, though a few news reports were floated in the international news market to say that Germans had killed civilians, had chopped the arms off of little children, had raped nuns, had nailed women to the sides of houses and violated them, and all of that. All of this was fiction, a total propaganda plan. And we'll talk about the purposes of that later. So that brutality was fictionalized and has a long history after it. It goes up to the present day. But these pieces of brutality that we're talking about, the Russians and the Germans, they both shot people in reprisal. They both shot women hanging up their clothes on the wash line, thinking that they were signaling their countrymen to come and fight. They both blew up towns in the process of the fighting and burned towns to the ground. The Germans actually burned the library at Louvain, although it's not quite sure whether this was on purpose or not. A pearl of one of the jewels of European civilization burned down there. Some manuscripts that never can be replaced. That was kind of the end of an era in terms of some medieval sources. But at Louvain. The Germans certainly were brutal to the population, and it may be that somebody set fire on purpose to the library. So we already have And let's see, I believe we're at the end of it. Yeah, this is our last one. Already at the very first stages of the war, we have this kind of brutality introduced. Now, I started late, and as I said, I will go a little late. We're at the hour and a half point from actual starting now, but I will stay with you as long as you have questions to talk, and as long as we can manage to get along. So let's start the question and answer now, and I've got both the Q&A and the chat on my screen. My people, I can see you and hear you if you write it down. And so here we go. And Steve Wise has a question right now on slide number 29. Does the Austrian number of casualties include Hungarians too? Yes, it does. That's all the Austrian casualties. I just said that as a shorthand. It's Austro-Hungarian casualties. Sorry. But that's both. That's the Habsburg army. It also called K and K, Kaiserliche und Königliche, the imperial and royal army, because the Habsburg army was headed by the Habsburg emperor, who was also king of Hungary, so he was both emperor and king. Okay, other questions. Let me see. Steve says, when did Russia begin mobilizing on the German border? They were mobilizing on both borders at the same time, but it was partial mobilization. And it's in that list of remember I marked it out and it said the full, but I marked it out and said it's partial. I'll change that. It's actually partial mobilization, and if my memory serves, it's on July 28th. I could be a day off on that. So, yeah, and they're mobilizing on the Austro-Hungarian border as well. So, but of course, the Austrians are already, their army is already mobilized because they're already at war with Serbia. And so the Russians are backing up the Serbs, seeing them as their Slav little brothers, and carrying that through that way. Let's see. Oh, up above. Laura says, what was the reaction of statesmen to the large number of casualties caused from the new technology involved in the war? They were expecting casualties, but was anyone surprised as to how bad it turned out to be in 1914? Excellent question, Laura. They were expecting, you remember last week we said they were expecting high casualties. Remember Bloch and a number of others had predicted that there would be enormous casualties. But the thing that went along with that was that they expected it all to be over really briefly. Everybody had, as the historian Farrar has said, everybody had a short war illusion. That nobody could believe that a country could spend so much as it would have to spend on these mass armies with this expensive high-tech equipment. And still carry on. I mean, nobody had any notion that any national budget on the face of the earth could match that for more than just a few months. And so they knew it would be tough, and they knew the casualties would be high. But somehow, I mean, eventually when all this came to light and everybody began to add up all these various butcher's bills from various battlefields, Then this became a horror. But of course, this wasn't publicized very much. They didn't put it in the paper, oh, we've lost millions already. This was all this was fairly censored information. But I think the government leaders began to say, what have we done? What's going on here? And how do we end it? But of course, then you have the argument, do you end it by going forward or going backward? And if we've already touched all this thing off, we can't very well say, oops, that was a mistake, and we didn't know it was going to be this bloody. So there's several considerations, but I think they were expecting very, very high casualties. let me see if there's one on the Q&A. Nathan Hayes asks if the church played any role at this time. I think the churches played the same role they play in most wars at this moment. That is to say, they just stood back and tried to counsel people in spiritual ways, and the change in attitudes in churches and in the heart of society and in families and so forth is going to come later. Certainly not in this period we're talking about. They really don't play very much of a role. I mean, they certainly are chaplains with every army, and the chaplains understand what's happening, and we'll talk about a few of those later on and some of that experience. But I don't think it's what you would call a substantial kind of contribution. John Anderson says, can you touch on the Austro-Hungarian battles in Serbia and Galicia in August and September? I think I'll save them to another time, John. That's a good question, and I think I'll just save that for the next time when I'm working on the Eastern Front a little bit more. Let me look down. Steve Wise asks, what factors contributed to the much higher casualty numbers that Russia experienced? Oh, well, the Russians attacked with an army that was that had some high-tech equipment, and we talked last time about their recent industrial surge, but certainly the Russians attacked with very little in the with very little depth in their army. They wanted to fight an industrial war. They wanted to use industrial tactics. They had learned many industrial type tactics against the Japanese in 1904 and 5. Their industrial capacity couldn't match it. And so as they went to war, they didn't have enough guns. They didn't have enough artillery pieces, and they didn't have enough weapons for the soldiers. So in these early attacks, there were many, many cases cited and that are cited in historical records where a regiment would attack, but it only had enough rifles for one troop in 16. And so, again, these Russians had to attack, many of them just running behind the guy with the rifle, and when he got killed, then somebody would pick it up, and when he got killed, somebody would pick it up. And eventually, you'd get a rifle, but at what cost? The one thing that the Russian commanders did was to replace technology with bodies, and they said, well, one thing we don't have much of is depth in technology, but we do have depth in bodies. We have a huge population, and so they used it. I mean, that's one thing they did. They also were convinced, like many other commanders, you didn't have to be backwards to think that the attack was still the preferred mode of operation. I mean, there were attack generals in every army, and practically all the French generals, with very few exceptions to the war. There's some prominent ones. But the generals who followed that whole philosophy that we discussed last week, the philosophy that originated with Dupuy, among others, the military psychologist, who said that basically if you're attacking, you have this sort of moral advantage, or at least morale advantage. And so the Russians, a lot of Russian generals thought that too and relied on the attack. So they got killed because they attacked so much and were out in the open, and because the Germans had more guns to blow them up. Let's see. Steve, that's an answer to your question. Let me move up to the human wave. Cam says human wave salt. That's exactly right. Let me go up here a little bit more. From Louis Maynard to all participants. Concerning the causes of the war, Benjamin Strong, first governor of the New York Fed under Morgan influence, ensured that the House of Morgans was the only U.S. buyer of French and British bonds, which they used to finance their war expenditures. Now, having a stake in the war, Rothbard, in the case against the Fed, citing Charles Callan Tandil's American Goes to War, argues that the Morgans played an important role in the decision of the U.S. to go into war on the British side. Have you come across evidence of this information, and do you think it's relevant? Oh, of course I think it's relevant. Yeah, in fact, I wrote about this in my article on the Merchants of Death that appeared, I think, in the Austrian Journal of Economics a few years back. Yeah, absolutely think it's relevant. And this the whole financial scheme that we talked about last week in terms of the loans to Russia cement that. Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I don't disagree with that at all. Let's see. Nathan Hayes, I'm going to skip down to the question and answer. It says, I'm reading Hoppe's Democracy, the God That Failed, which is very relevant, and was wondering how the legitimacy of the monarchs at the beginning of the war had been able to continue into the 20th century. Were they ordained by God? Well, I think the legitimacy of the monarchs had been questioned and assaulted, and I mean, there was a revolution in France. There were revolutions in Europe throughout Europe in 1830 and then in 1848. There have been challenges to monarchy, but certainly the monarchs were still on the thrones of nearly all European countries, and whether they had the legitimacy of religion, they certainly did still claim to be chosen from God. But I think they had the legitimacy of tradition, and people were just accustomed to the way that they ran things, and I think that amounted to their claim to fame, their claim to be the commanders of these great armies. I think people trusted the monarchs and their advisors to some extent, and that varies from place to place. But in the literature of this period of time, and this is a course we're going to be covering the whole war. I mean, and you have to ask broad questions at some point, but I mean, we're right now focusing on this pretty narrow segment of it. But in this period of time, if you think about the statements made by the Tsar, if you think about the statements made by Wilhelm II, you think about the literature that appears about the Belgian Queen tending hospital for Belgian troops and things like this. I think people trusted the monarchs and as heads of state like that continuity. So I think there's several factors in that, and certainly Hoppe's book is quite relevant to all this. Let's see. Leslie says, it seems that the Austrian aims in the Balkans were mainly defensive. They felt they were acting in self-defense. Russian aims, on the other hand, were ambitious. She was making a play for expansion of her power with an aim to get control of the straits. When push came to shove and Grey urged negotiations between Austria and Russia, Macaire and Palaiologue told Russia to stay firm and not negotiate. Austria was willing to negotiate, but the Russians declined. Well, that's true. I mean, it is true. Also, Leslie, I agree. I think that the Russians, I mean, in the end, we can say they were all guilty, but everybody's guilt consisted in something, in some other move or behavior or failure to move or failure to behave. But I certainly think that the Russians were quite aggressive, and I agree with you that that theirs was a foreign adventure to begin with. They had lost their friend in Bulgaria. They had adopted the Serbs as their Pan-Slav brothers and sisters. They had, since the Serbs came up so favorably in the course of the Balkan Wars, they thought, well, we'll put all our faith in the Serbs. This was in essence a kind of aggressive attempt. The defending of the Serbs was in its own right a kind of aggressive stance. And it's also true that the mobilization was quite aggressive, that it's very, very clear that by mobilizing partially, it kind of, you know, broke the rules and helped bring on the war. The Russians and French had been planning for such things, just the way the Germans had been planning for such things and everybody else. So they were very aggressive. And I agree that when Grey urged negotiations, that the French did, back the Russians up. So there is something to this. I mean, we go through stages of this, and for a long time after the First World War, even some revisionists still disliked Austria because they said, well, the Austrians, you know, look what they did. They started a whole thing, and for this little bitty cause of having their, you know, this act of terrorism happen. And then, of course, the Germans came in for it, and then we can talk about the British and French. And the French did have, I'd have to say, I think the French had a lesser part in starting this probably than anybody else, but they helped too. I mean, it does take a team to kind of make all this happen, in my view. Let's see. Laura asks, we hear World War I as being a European war, but it seems that the powerful countries are the ones being spoken about. So did the Scandinavian countries, Sweden, etc., participate in this war at all? Sweden was neutral in the war, and Denmark was neutral. And they were all remained neutral in the war. We'll talk about the neutrals a little bit later. I mean, this really interesting problem, not problem, a really interesting phenomenon, that there were countries who just opted out and just said, no, we're not going to do that. The Netherlands was one. Spain was, of course, neutral. And Italy remained neutral for a while. Well, even the Ottomans remained neutral for a while. But there is this core of neutrals, including Sweden and Denmark, and that's where the Scandinavian countries stood. All right. So, have we more questions? We're at 9:04, but I am going strong, and I'm ready to answer any questions. I even have my arrow on. I need to cut that on. Okay. Any more questions about tonight's? Maynard asks, why wasn't Germany able to come to an agreement with Belgium without attacking them, just negotiating a way to pass through? That's a good question. I think there are there are a couple of good answers. One was that Belgium was thought of at this time as a kind of extension of British foreign policy. And it's true that the Treaty of London that kind of guaranteed Belgian neutrality was a multilateral treaty. And Prussia signed it back before there was a Germany. Just like everybody else did, but the British were the force behind that, and so the Belgians thought of themselves as a little bit of an extension of the British. I mean, in the same way today that if British people want to retire somewhere where the food is really good life is a little bit less hectic than in England, then a lot of them retire to Belgium where they could, you know, where they can have some great French fries and mussels and all of that. So it's a kind of an extension, and it was thought of in that way. And so for this reason, I don't think anybody in Europe supposed that if Germany asked Belgium to allow them to go through, that the Belgians would say yes. One thing the Belgians were counting on was that the British would attack, that the British would back them. But what we know from the documents is that the Germans didn't ask. They decided not to ask. And what Bethmann Hollweg, the German chancellor, said was that, well, you know, there are times when you just have to act and get permission later, get forgiveness later. What is the expression? Whatever it is, we won't ask permission now, we'll just apologize later, or whatever that is. And Bethmann said as much before German Parliament. When there was a question about it there in the Bundestag, he said, well, you know, or the Reichstag, he said the thing is, they wouldn't have said yes. And this way, it's short and quick, We just go through Belgium. We just fight in that mode, and then after the war, we'll make some arrangement with them. So that's the reason they thought about it and just didn't do it. Easier to ask forgiveness than for permission. Thank you, Steve. Excellent. Yeah, I'm a little I'm thinking too much about these events in 1914. Do you know the state of private gun ownership, gun rights at this time? It seems invading an armed nation would be difficult. Well, Nathan, the people had guns all over the place. There weren't really any gun laws in effect. But frankly, most Europeans didn't have anything that would match any of the weapons of any of these armies. You think about these fine rifles, for example, Springfield rifle or a Mauser rifle that these armies carry, sighted in at 700 yards, no problem. A fine piece of craftsmanship and so forth, bullet after bullet. I mean, it's just a wonderful machine. And what people had at their home were fowling pieces and things like that. So there was no sense. I mean, Europe was a totally peaceful place. Nobody expected to be invaded. Crime was just almost nil. I mean, there was almost no reason to even have home protection. People lived with their houses unlocked and things. There was no such thing as papers, you know, for identity papers or anything like that. It was a different era. It really was, as they called it, la belle époque. It was a beautiful time, and people didn't expect anything like this. So no, they didn't have guns. But there are many cases where, you know, somebody would just be so furious and scared and nervous in Belgium because they heard about this attack coming. You know, they knew the Germans were coming. They knew that Liège couldn't hold, and so there's this tension all over Belgium. The Germans are coming. When they get there, then they just kind of, you know, or they throw a brick, or they do something, you know, they take a shot or whatever, and then the Germans carry out reprisals. But yeah, that's a good question. But they didn't have any weapons to match anything close to what. And I don't even mention artillery. I mean, you know, if they can turn artillery piece on your house, then. Let's see. Kim puts up this list of things, list of infantry weapons in the war. Thank you, Cam. You know, I also want to thank Cam and introduce him. I don't know if I remember to introduce him in the first evening or not, but he's, of course, the assistant to this course, and he's a historian in his own right, and he's got some books on Amazon.com. He's a kind of authority on ancient warfare and other issues of an ancient nature, but he knows about modern warfare because he's been in it, I suppose. So anyway, Kim, thank you for helping this evening and last evening and for the rest of this course. I appreciate it. And everybody, if you have any praise for the course, just write that to me. And if you have any problems, just tell Cam, and he'll take care of it. Yes, go Cam. Are there any more questions about tonight's information? I only sidestepped one, but that's because we're going to treat that in a kind of coherent, that Galicia question in a kind of coherent way later on. Any more questions? Going once. Going twice. Okay, I think we're finished. If there are no questions, thank you so much, everybody. I apologize for the technical delay at the beginning, and I will work hard to clear all that up and figure all that out. So thank you very much. Cam declares that it's coffee time. Seems a little late for coffee, but since he says it, I believe I'll go have some. Thank you very much.